You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Cees Notenboom. He is a Dutch writer whose book, which won the European Literary Award, The Following Story, has recently been published by Harkett Brace. You know, for some time, he's been being translated into English and published here by the Louisiana State University Press. And several of the titles have in the past been available from Penguin International in paperback, and you may still find them in your local bookstores if you're a searcher, like many of us are. I thought I'd begin, since your work is by and large new to Americans, by saying that all of these books are very short and extremely compressed, and toward the end of In the Dutch Mountains, you have a note about the black hole in astronomy and physics, a space so extremely compressed that everything is held in very tightly and nothing can escape. This seems to be a metaphor for these books in general. What attracts you to compression?
First of all, I think it comes naturally, but there has been also a vindication. For 30 years, a very, very good friend of Mary McCarthy. She lived in Europe, as you know, and I met her on a writer's festival, and though nothing of mine was translated at the time, she seemed to like me, and I visited her a lot and went with her to Venice and Florence and stayed with her in Maine, where she was in the summer. And she knew a few of my Dutch writer friends. She had something with Holland. She came there to research for her novel, Cannibals and Missionaries. And she asked me about their work, and I said that they were writing normally huge books, big books, books of many, many words, let's say 600, 800 pages. And then at one of these occasions, she looked at me and said, "Cees, you stay small." and I felt, yes. I don't do it on purpose, though. It happens that way. And it's not that I'm, let's say, too lazy, because there's another part of my writing which is not at all known yet in this country, and that's my travel books. Now, for example, my last two travel books are one on Berlin, which is quite normal size, but the one on Spain would be a 400-page book. So, but for fiction, the kind of statement I seem to want to make, because as you say, it's about nothing, really. I don't know the exact words, the way you used them, but that is my feeling too. The plot, or even the story, they are just... I'm looking for the word pretexts for a text, the pretext for writing. Quite often when I begin a book, I don't even know what it's going to be, which afterwards is quite astonishing to me myself. For example, in this book, The Following Story, I have the feeling that I made a salto mortale up in the air and came down on my feet. It's round completely, and... I don't think the way I write, I like to think writing, if you see. And you couldn't go on that way for 300 pages. What I obviously do, I can only say it by deduction, what I obviously do is think about the book, sort of subterranean way. And then when the right moment is there, without knowing exactly what's going to happen, I throw myself into this adventure that the writing of a book is. And I can only do it when I see 3-4 months in front of me with absolutely nothing. And I go to an isolated place on a Spanish island where I have a small place. And I have no telephone and no fax. And I completely live in the book. And then it must be finished after those 3-4 months.
And yet it seems to me at the same time that there is, for better or worse, a tradition of short books, tales, really.
Mm-hmm.
In English, Henry James in books like The Turn of the Screw or The Jolly Corner, the story, or E.T.A. Hoffman in some of his longer tales. These seem to be a mixture of, would you say, fantasy and philosophy?
Yes.
Their brevity seems to be required by the extreme credulity being demanded of the reader. And it seems to be a kind of mesmerizing fictional-philosophical form that doesn't weigh too heavily on either side. The point is to create a lighter-than-air structure.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And I would say it especially goes for my last four books. What I did before that, I was 20 and 20-something, was all done in complete innocence. Now, you cannot pretend to remain innocent. So I know, I know. When you say the word you use was credulence, is that it?
Credulity.
credulity. Yes, it has to be. It's an act. It's almost like a circus act. It's up in the air, and I must not fall off, because I would fall off together with the reader, and because I write the book somehow with a reader, whoever it is, he, she, but I'm together with somebody when I write the books. And if I fall off, he or she would fall off, so we can't have that. So there is a kind of fairy tale time, a magic moment which I must sustain over those few months, otherwise it won't work. I want to think, but I don't want to be heavy. And as a matter of fact, when this book came out, in it was translated first of all in German, that what they said is what this writer does is that he has heavy stuff, themes, but he treats it very lightly, and this is what I try. With my examples, therefore, are not so much, I would say, Henry James, though, of course, I admire the term screw, but I would think more in the way of Voltaire or Diderot, which are my. If you see, you can buy a book called Les Romans de Voltaire, and then you have it in one paperback volume. You have 24 novels. Some of them are really extremely short. Well, this is what I'm aspiring at, yes.
At the same time, to jump over to what we might call the philosophical side, that relationship with an invisible reader that you just talked about seems very much to be the Platonic side of these books. In at least the ones that I've read, there is that sense from Plato's Symposium, as expressed by Aristophanes, of an original wholeness that has now fallen into division. Mm-hmm. And so there's very much the sense in many of these books that the reader completes a gesture of the writer and makes the writer's action a whole,
mm-hmm.
or that the loved one completes the beloved, or that Europe completes Holland.
Yes. Or the North, the South.
Yes. But always the sense, the past, the present, that there is a division in the physical world that must be somehow healed by the act of writing fiction.
Well, one of the definitions, and don't ask me names, but one of the definitions of art is the conjunctio oppositorum, that is the joining of things opposed, really. In the last book, for example, it is really life and death, isn't it? I have read in some of the reviews, even, let's say, the favorable reviews, and there were some very favorable, but I feel that they do not always get it right when they say my man is dead. You know, the protagonist of the following story, in my opinion, is not dead. He's throughout the book. in the last 2 seconds of his life, but nobody knows how long those seconds can be. And as far as I'm concerned, they can be immensely long, and enough in any way, in any case, to tell this whole story.
Well, it is, in a sense, mystifying to me, because I've read many of those reviews, and I must say that I think that if there's a book that tells you what you need to think,
yes,
it is the following story, and all of these people race for interpretation. He is already dead. He is, you know, between life and death. The book is very precise about
yes,
this.
If you read it carefully.
If it's read carefully.
He has a heart attack. He indicates twice, I would say, if you read it carefully. And some of those people say that they read it twice. But anyway, the two moments where he, in his, let's say, dream that he has during this attack, which he doesn't feel as something painful, that he sees himself and he sees the clock besides his bed, and he sees that the, how do you call it,
the minute hand.
Yes, has not progressed. It's still where it is, maybe just 1 second. So that is, I would say, for a real reader, should be clear. And secondly, the other man, that's the only place where I leave the reader completely free. As far as I'm concerned, the reader decides what he sees there. I'm speaking now about the book that they haven't read, so I find that a bit difficult. But the man in this book goes to bed in Amsterdam, and he wakes up in Lisbon, which is improbable, though in the book it is, I think, probable. And then after a few days in Lisbon, he boards a ship with 6 other people, one woman, who is clearly, in my opinion, again, death. And like in all Latin languages, death is feminine, la muerte, la mort. And all these men are in the last 2 seconds of their lives. Only, just as with my man, those seconds last so long.
And the telling of the story, for each of these men, death is the significant woman in their lives. They are telling their stories, the stories that occupy their lives in the last moment of their lives, to a hallucinated presence of someone who has been in some way crucial or dear to them. In the case of the narrator, it's a young student. Her name is Lisa Dindia.
Yes.
And she is perhaps the woman who has been most dear to him, because sexually shy, he has never felt anything but, so to speak, a platonic relationship. He says of her that his categorical imperatives are very strong, and he has never violated it with her. He's a moral man. She is his student. He feels himself to be ugly to the point of gnomishness or monstrousness, so there's a terrible self-consciousness of his physicality. He speaks of a terrible desire he had to be muscled and icy blue-eyed, but he is at his best when respecting another person and being respected.
Absolutely, yes. Some women said to me that they find him horrible, and this really hurts me, because he isn't horrible. He is a tender soul in a rather ugly exterior, and he is caustic because of his ugliness, but he's essentially shy. And the point is, like I would say in A la recherche du temps perdu, in Proust's novel, that only at the end of let's say, Marcel's life, he realizes that Gilberte would have gone for him if he had only gone on or gone through with it or gone further with it. And so my Hermann Mussert, at the very end of his life, realizes that she was his great love and not the other person he was so obviously physically in love with. And, yes.
Well, it's a very interesting structure because everything has been made duong in the novel by my guest, Sais Notabom, author of the following story, published by Harkat Brace Jovanovich, which we are now discussing. Everything is doubled. And so while he is a classic scholar and his great love is Ovid's Metamorphosis, there is next door a teacher of biology, and for her, metamorphosis is a process that occurs in the body after death as it rots or is eaten by mites and worms. For him, metamorphosis is a matter of spirit and soul and the gods and anti-psychological to boot. And so, you know, he lives in a world that's very involved in trying to hook his spiritual nature and tie it to the earth and the process of rotting, where he is involved in a process of transfiguration of a more acrobatic mental kind. Yes?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Now you're up till now. I shouldn't be flattering you. You're up till now my best reader. Let me add something to it. And then you think, oh, have I been clever when I hear it this way? But I didn't know I was going to do those things beforehand. You see, their opposition, the fact that he is this Ovid person obsessed with the idea of metamorphosis, that she, on the other hand, is a positivist, one should say, that breaks down all his great ideas to physical fact, that if he speaks about time, she speaks about time in the physical sense. He speaks about it in eventually even a romantic or a psychological sense. If he speaks about memory, she will speak about brain cells. This is of course what sets them apart and in a certain way unites them, because they have really something to talk about, the two of them.
I noticed, well, it was unavoidable. The epigraph to the second section of the novel is from Nabokov's final novel, Transparent Things. I believe it's the final novel. Who Looked at the Harlequins may have come after.
No, Look at the Harlequins was after that.
Yes.
And he
completed one more that has never been published, I believe, called The Original of Laura.
Yes.
But in that novel, Transparent Things, a man goes back to a hotel to relive a series of deaths and presumably to die himself.
Yes.
And this book, too, finds our hero going to bed in Amsterdam, Herman Mussert. He wakes up in Lisbon. It is the hotel in which he spent the happiest but also most difficult physical moments of his life, with the woman biology teacher from next door, a married woman. And I wondered, what is the relationship between the Nabokov novel and this novel, or between Nabokov and yourself?
Yes, well, the second thing is far more difficult. The second thing I would say is simple. There, my role is that of admirer. But what struck me, there are three instances in Nabokov where, after reading him better than I did when I was younger, I was struck by the idea that he believed in an afterlife, in a very personal afterlife. So there were three things. One is this beautiful story, The Vane Sisters, you know, where two sisters from the hereafter indicate to somebody where he has to go in order to hear about them. I'm saying, and that becomes clear with a very complicated acrosticon at the end, but let's not go into that. But then, that's one. Secondly, there's the quotation in my book, the quotation where he says that it will be very difficult to maneuver oneself from one state of being into the other, meaning life into death. That combined with the fact that from the latest biography of Nabokov by William Boyd, I understood that he really believed in a most practical, personal way in this kind of thing. But earlier in the book, and I didn't use that as a quotation, though I used it as a working motto. There is a not named quotation that nobody has picked up, not even the Germans, by Ernst Jünger, this now 99-year-old German writer and sort of mystical person.
Who wrote On the Marble Cliffs,
yes.
Which is a book not well enough known in America, and no. The Glass Beads.
Yeah, he's one of the... he's in Germany, of course, a very important writer. I wouldn't say I side with him on everything, but he's interesting enough. He's so old, and he's played this strange role. He's also a sort of shaman, samurai, and all that. But anyway, I have a quotation by him somewhere in the beginning where I say that we will hear it, a draft coming through the cracks of causality or something. And that's out of a book of his called the Zeitmauer, that means the Wall of Time, in which he too claims that just before we will cross the Wall of Time, just before and just after, all kind of things will happen to us. Now, I do not, I think, personally subscribe that, but that's the idea behind the book. What happens before, what happens while, and what happens after we're dying. And it's really about that. And so there's both Nabokov and Ernst Jünger.
Well, it's quite hilarious because in groping to place you, the reviewers now provide and this I'm mentioning for the sake of American readers who are learning about Sees Notenboom for the first time, perhaps on this show. At some points you are linked with Calvino, with Borges, with Umberto Eco, with Milan Kundera. I think by the time you're finished with the list, Nabokov, many others, they're trying to say that this is a writer of world distinction. But what tradition do you align yourself to? Who are the writers that you were drawn most to?
Well, may I first say something about what you just said? These comparisons, of course, are marvelous and all that, but now compare the short and fantastic Borges to, let's say, Ada of Nabokov.
Exactly.
And there you say, well, what? And take then again Mr. Palomar and the last book by the Immortality by Kundera. It's not very strong, those relationships. The only thing you could say, these are books that somehow represent the life of the spirit, then okay, then I would say yes, yes, please, okay. Your question was...
Who are the writers that you yourself feel an affiliation with or an inspiration from?
You'll be surprised, probably. When I was... I was educated by monks... I was educated, and this has helped me along later in life. I didn't know it then. I had a very thorough Greek and Latin classical education, first of all. These things are still important to me. I will still read bilingual, though, editions with a love to look at the Latin, but okay, it takes up too much time to read it only in Latin. But I read the classics. And... then, as I said, Voltaire, Diderot, because of their brilliance and lightness, and especially with Diderot, his formidable freedom of digressing, not at all to do with what we call nowadays realism, which I think should be led to television and films. Proust is the most important author to me that I really have read and read and read. I do not read that much fiction, I must confess. And then again, when I was 19, I read Truman Capote, Grassharp, and especially Other Voices, Other Rooms. This certainly has influenced me on my first novel that I wrote when I was 19, 20.
Within every novel, there is, for any reader, a projected figure of the author.
Oh, yes.
Not one who would exist if you met him, but one that you hypothesize. So for me, the Voltaire, certainly of Zadig, is so ferocious
yes.
that I would not like to I'd be afraid.
No, no,
of
one
him.
Would be afraid. Yes. On the other hand, the Voltaire of Candide, one could sit back
Yes. The Diderot of the Talking Jewels is so licentious and witty that one would not trust him around anyone one loved.
Well, yes. And one would be very much on one's guard with the Diderot of, I don't know how it's called in English, but Jacques le Fataliste.
Yes.
You would have to watch out all the time. but you see, this is the thing. People say, when they're confronted with novels that they call, I hate the word, postmodern, they say, give us the old-fashioned storyteller. And that's where I think they have it completely wrong, because these are stories and they are told by a storyteller. And that's especially the point of In the Dutch Mountains, where you have the storyteller himself all the time there, Tiburon. And I must say that's my favorite role. You can't write books about writers all the time. That would be extremely boring. But there I at least found a writer that is an amateur. So I had an excuse to go on a little bit about him.
Yes, one of the pleasures of In the Dutch Mountains is that it's a novel narrated by a road builder who sits in a vacant schoolhouse during the summers, writing novels that are published by Spanish publishers so small that he doesn't have to worry in particular about being read.
Yes.
And he's quite right, because he has the right instincts as a storyteller, but not the best language. He's very timid and haphazard in his constructions, intentionally. He is telling a fairy tale, but he can't exactly tell it, because really the fairy tale he's telling is not one that will include him. His real story is a story of loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
His wife is away. He's alone in a schoolroom. He's locked in childhood. He's been played with by a male teacher when he was young, and so he is sexually in an occluded state, and he's trying to project a fairy tale that he can't exactly tell or finish, because it is about perfection, and what would he know about it?
Yeah, yeah. I like to play with this kind of forms. The fairy tale especially is very important, and I certainly wouldn't want the books to be, let's say, stone heavy. But it takes time to make a book light. This is the most important thing. It takes. Nothing is more heavy, I would say. Nothing is heavier as trying to be light, and yet at the same time serious, if I may say so.
Well, it's like that saying, I don't remember whose it is, if I had time, I would have written a shorter letter.
Yes.
I've been speaking to Sees Notenboom, the author most recently of the following story, published by Harkett Brace Jovanovich, and of five other novels that have been translated into English and are available from the Louisiana State University Press. Thank you for joining
Thank
me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in bucks.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.